All right. I'm only going to spend a little bit, and then we're going to go review. Hildebrand, the reforming pope. We're still in the 10th century. By the 10th century, the papacy had sunk to its lowest depths through immorality and the practice of simony, S-I-M-O-N-Y. A Benedictine monastery founded in Cluny, France in 910 sought to lift the church above the chaos, and in so doing became so influential through its establishment of nearly 70 other monasteries. The Cluniacs taught strict celibacy of the clergy. Now, it was in reaction to the fact that the clergy had such power. If you believed in what's called auricular or oral confession, and if you listened to a lot of sins being confessed, you would get very close to people, especially women, who are telling you all of their inner thoughts and all of their depression. And it's really a danger still to this day. In the 1960s, 70s, and 80s, you had everybody going to a counselor. As soon as people got fed up at the church, they all went to counselors because everybody has to confess their sins. Everybody has it wired inside of them to tell somebody about their struggles. So the priests were taking all this on and using that information as a means to manipulate the penitents. And the priests, who wanted to act consoling and wanted to act very, very understanding, would become emotionally bonded, especially to women they wanted to be with. And it became, there was just so much sin going around. And even though the priest may have or may not have been married, they were involved with lots of other women. And so the Cluniacs declared total celibacy. And basically, women weren't even allowed to give, for a while, weren't allowed to give confession, just the men were. It was to try and control the sin that was rampant in the clergy. They taught strict celibacy of the clergy and sought to place total control of the church in the hands of the clergy, seeking to remove all lay and state controls. They wanted to take freedom back from the state being in control. The most prominent Cluniac was a guy named Hildebrand, a young monk who became a zealous ecclesiastic and promoter of reforms. As papal advisor, Hildebrand virtually controlled five papal administrations from 1049 to 1073, and he was himself elected pope in 1073. He took the name Gregory VII as the only pope better known by his family name. He was pope from 1073 to 1085. Here are his reforms. He cleaned up the clergy and established the supremacy of the Roman Catholic Church. He did this through outlawing simony. Now, simony is what? Buying of office and that powers and authorities in the church. He enforced celibacy. Up to this time, celibacy was only urged upon the priesthood. Hildebrand even forced the married priests to separate from their wives. He ended secular nomination of clergy, meaning the mayor couldn't nominate somebody to be a pope or to be a priest. Popes and bishops were, up until that time, nominated by kings and emperors. It was customary for bishops to receive a staff and a ring from their secular sovereign at their consecration, thus pledging feudal allegiance to them. This practice virtually made bishops appointees of the current ruler and fostered the corruption of simony. It was just, what do they call it, where you, it's not nepotism, but it's like the mafia. I mean, it's all controlled. The mayor has a hand in electing the priests, and the priests have a hand in electing. It wasn't democracy at all. number five, Hildebrand forbade this practice. He also required charges against priests to be dealt with by ecclesiastical courts rather than by civil courts. Why? Just by understanding this, why was he trying to take it and get the church to deal with it? Scripture. Well, I mean, these were accusations against priests that were of not just doctrinal matters, but immoral matters and abuse matters. It was because there was so much corruption in the government. And so he tried to make it so that, listen, we're going to be very hard on our guys, harder than these other guys who were. It's like, would you submit, if there's a problem in the church, would you submit it to the mafia? And no, you wouldn't. You deal with it. He had some good desires, okay? Declaring papal supremacy, Hildebrand issued a didatus. That's an early bull. Declaring the Roman Church was founded by God alone. The Roman Pope alone is the universal bishop. Boy, he was very arrogant. The Pope alone may use the imperial insignia. The Pope's feet alone may be kissed by princes. The Pope may depose emperors. Now he's going to the place where he says, I can crown and depose an emperor. The Pope may be judged by no one. The Roman Church has never erred, nor will it ever err. Is that still believed today?
Well, why did he have reforms?
He saw corruption, but he didn't see error. There's a difference. I can see somebody doing wrong, but rarely do people think about, are they thinking wrong? And are they believing wrong? But the Roman Church has never erred, nor will it ever err. It's still believed today. Oh, the priests are bad, but the church is good. That's what they'll say. That's what they say. It's still in their nature. As Pope Gregory VII, Hildebrand referred to himself as the overlord of kings and princes. Now, he had something called the investiture. Now, that just means the empowerment struggle. Emperors such as Otto I, Otto the Great, and Otto III, and Henry III, all of whom bore the title King of Germany in the Holy Roman Empire, had exercised great control over the affairs of the Church of Rome, in some ways saving the Church from collapse into anarchy during the reign of immoral popes. So these guys who were in the secular realm, again, where's my pen? You have two realms. You have one realm that we'll call the spiritual realm. And that spiritual realm was composed of the church. And then you had what was called the secular realm. And there's where your kings and mayors and all of the normal rulers and princes, stuff like that. Now these two realms were separate, and I believe them are, they are supposed to be separate. But what happened was, when the popes in here took it to new lows, these guys were much, even though they were unregenerate, they weren't Christian at all, but they held stability while the popes were going through their disasters. Later on, when the secular realm was going down, these guys took the realm, took control, and kept control, because these guys would be corrupt. And when you start to say, what is Christianity supposed to do in these situations? When your government is falling apart because of corruption, what should Christians do?
Okay, pray is very good.
There's only one way to change a nation. By changing the hearts of men. Not by changing the government. Right now, everybody's saying, change the government, change the government. I don't think change the government is going to fix this country. Number two, I think the government we're getting into is going to be twice as bad as the one that we've got. The devil we know at least is stable. But they always want change. And my point is, nobody wants to change on the inside. There's a group in the middle here, and these are called Bible believers. And Bible believers ought to be affecting both directions. Let's just call this religionist. Okay? And we should, through preaching, it is through the preaching of the cross that God has chosen to save them that believe. So both of these things are going to go back and forth. Religion is constantly going to be influencing the secular world, and the secular government is going to constantly be influencing, controlling religion. They have their hand in each other's pockets. We stand aside and we preach and we affect the world from the sidelines. We're never going to be totally accepted. Does that mean that we should not be involved in government? Of course you should be. Daniel would never have been second ruler in the country of Babylon if God had forbade it. Joseph, God put him second in command. There is a place for Christians having a role in government, just like Christians are supposed to have an influence in Christian. We should be the greatest writers. We should be writing and influencing the internet. When people go on the internet and look for questions about evolution, they should get a Christian page that gives truth. We should be writing. We shouldn't just be sitting on the sidelines and letting the world go to hell. Christians should be affecting both realms. People, if we lived in Thailand and everybody was believing, or let's go to Japan. Let's go. If every right now we're all, oh, let's not go to Japan. Let's go. I'm trying to find something. Thailand. I'm just not up on all the Buddhist teachings. But if everybody around us is Buddhist, we should be influencing. We should be writing about the superiority of the life of a Christian, the superiority of the life of believing prayer, not meditation. We should be influencing religion, yes or no? Yes. And we should be influencing politics. Okay? Not that we take over and we all of a sudden we say we're going to now control politics. You can't be Taoiseach unless we have anointed you. You understand how it goes? So you're seeing, and this was always going on throughout history. These are called Anabaptists. As a general rule, they all were Anabaptistic, if I can spell it correctly for some reason. They were all Anabaptists. They were Anabaptistic in their doctrine, and these guys always influenced both realms. They didn't stay in this realm or just get stuck into like Calvinism did. Calvinism took over this realm. Yes, sir?
I was just curious about how we change the winds. Like, are we supposed to be vocal about our political views? Or are we opening up the can of worms there? Do you know what I mean? Like, if we were to be influential on the political realm today, other than actually getting into politics and actually being in office.
How can you not be expressing a political view? How come we are primary?
To be very vocal about it, is that what
you're saying? Very is a dangerous term. Very vocal about it. We need to be vocal about it, or else abortion's coming in. End of story. If Christians do not fight for the empowerment of the individual for decisions, see, what we're losing right now is total sovereignty. What we're losing is the inability. Ireland now has no vote, has no ability to say, you know what, we should have gone, I believe, like Iceland and just defunct 5 banks and just let them fall off the planet. Okay? But Ireland, as a nation, has not been allowed to choose that. It's just been done, dictated by Europe. So I believe that we should be rallying people to realize that, you know, God says the greatest decisions have to be made based on truth. What do people believe? What do they know? And most people have never been told the whole truth about what the banks knew. They don't believe in that, and we've got to express that. Now, we deal with on a foundational level. We constantly give out information, all right? And that's supposed to change people's views in their ability to make decisions. So we constantly do that. If we only preach the gospel, which is the beginning, that's the foundation, that's fine, but we would end up in our little communities in Galway, or let's put ourselves up in Connacht or out in Kerry, and we would all be living Amish, and we'd all be just having our own little, and that's not what God called us to do. God said, go into all the world, not run from the world. So I'm supposed to be involved. I'm supposed to be participating in every area of life. So we should have an opinion about politics. You know, we should. Okay.
Would a pastor view that from the pulpit, like in trying to encourage his church to vote in a certain way?
That's a dangerous thing. I do not know how far to take that. I do believe that you are supposed to empower people with information. That's true. Okay, but as far as a person telling people what to vote, I think you're wrong there. See, the priests always get up there and say, to be a Catholic, you have to vote against this, you have to vote against that. That gets becomes dangerous to me. And again, those are realms that are constantly going to be debated, and but at least we ought to be involved. When we hide, we're letting the world go to hell. Because they don't understand the gospel in context. Yes, sir?
Well, there are things that are clear-cut that you could preach since we need to vote when it comes to abortion.
Yeah, well, this is what the Bible says.
This is what the Bible says?
Yes. But I cannot say...
That's not what you say, it's what the Bible says.
That's right, that's right.
I know what you mean.
Yeah.
So there is a way of from the pulpit, but it's what the Bible says.
And I haven't worked it all out, because I'm not, you know, I mean, if Ireland was debating on abortion, I would all of a sudden get on a political bandwagon. End of story. You're not stopping me. I would get involved. And I don't have, right now I don't have the time, but that would rally where we'd have to get information out. I'm just passionate about that. I wish people had been 20 years ago passionate about teaching not just religion in school, but the Bible in school. But now it's only philosophy that's taught in schools now, and so we've lost that battle. If we're going to get people so that evolution's not taught, it's going to be a long, hard battle to get the creationist view taught. We just lost a lot of momentum. But some of the things like abortion, we're going to have to fight, or else we'll lose it. It'll take decades before it ever gets recovered, if it even is recovered. This is very important. The church history teaches us, by their errors, how to do it better. Okay? So I want you to always find this point where we are influencing both realms, but we don't hide from both realms. Let's keep going. In number two, the Hildebrandian reforms soon resulted in a head-on collision with the secular rulers, leading to a long struggle between the imperial party, secular party, and the papist party over in Rome. During this investiture, or this empowerment struggle, who's got the most power, kings would depose and elect popes, while popes would depose kings. At times, two popes were elected, and the non-Roman ones were being referred to as anti-popes. Everybody was just shooting everybody else. Hildebrand himself came into conflict with King Henry IV, who in 1076 summoned a synod of German bishops, and the king compelled them to vote for the deposition of the pope. He made them say, "We depose the pope." Gregory retaliated by excommunicating. Now this is wild. He went and he said, "I now send you to hell." I mean, what a thing. And he absolved, he says, and all his subjects no longer have to obey. You no longer have to obey your king. And so nobody started to obey him. They believed the pope, and nobody started to obey the king. Under this papal ban, Henry became powerless, and a year later was forced to stand as a penitent in sackcloth and barefooted in the snow for 3 days outside the pope's castle at Canossa to receive absolution. That's how much power the pope had. Wow, man. Now, it's almost that way with the press. The press can crucify Brian Cowan and could have made him stand out there in sackcloth, in the snow, barefoot for 3 days outside the Irish Times, being repentant about all of his damage he did to the country over the last 10 years. You understand what I'm saying? That's the power of the press by turning the people against him. All right? You see a little taste of what the Pope did. After, now this is great, he's sitting there saying, "Please forgive me." But he was not penitent. Look at this. After Henry had his excommunication lifted, no longer going to hell, he declared war on the Pope. He desolated Italy and besieged Rome. He wasn't going to let the Pope have that power anymore. Gregory was driven from Rome and he died in exile. The wars between Italy and Germany continued over many years until the reign of Pope Innocent III. Aren't they wonderful names? The record of Hildebrand's so-called achievements overshadow his ultimate demise. He made the papacy independent of secular power, which was his greatest accomplishment at that time. And his papal anathema, papal cursing, as wielded by him in that ignorant and superstitious age, became a terrible weapon of injustice and oppression. He just threatened to always damn somebody who disagreed with him, just as this charismatic did when I was trying to cross-examine him, and he says, "You're in danger of going to hell because you're questioning me." High Middle Ages, 1000 to 1299. You've got important people, Anselm, the Roman Eastern split, what we have now, the Eastern Church, Eastern Orthodox Church, and the Roman Catholic Church. You have the Crusades. I wish we could go through all of this. I wish we had another 2 weeks. The Waldensians, some of my favorite Anabaptists, Francis of Assisi, sorry, and Thomas Aquinas. In 1014, Pope Benedict VIII officially added Filioque to the Nicene Creed. We talked about that several weeks ago. It means that the Holy Spirit proceeds from the Father and the Son. He did this to insist on the equality of the deity, but the Eastern Church insists that the Father alone is the origin of both the Son and the Spirit. They are offended in the West that the West altered the creed without an ecumenical council. They get really upset. In 1033, a guy named Anselm, father of Scholasticism, He proposed the ontological argument for the existence of God. He argued for the necessity of the incarnation and the redemption of Christ. I forget what ontological means. The great schism, I was going to look it up, but I forgot. The great schism of the church, and still broken. The break between Constantinople and Rome after 500 years of progressive in estrangement and a failed attempts at consensus. 1054, they just walk out and they never have come back into the Roman church. So when you hear somebody talk about the one holy apostolic Catholic faith, just laugh at them. It's not one. They had a split in 1054 and they never have recovered. They know that half of the Catholic Church is Eastern Orthodox. It's not one holy apostolic Catholic faith. It's not holy either, by the way. Anyway, Pope Gregory the VII excommunicated Henry the Fourth. We just read that. Run on down here. 1096, 1099, the First Crusade. This is very important. It fought for lofty ideals. The Pope wanted to save Constantinople, save the Byzantine Empire. From who? Anybody know?
Islam.
And thus heal the breach between the Eastern and Western Church. They were temporarily and they were also able to temporarily regain the Holy Land. It actually was only half of Islam, Barry. The Holy Land was under Islam, but they went down there. The Muslims were they were fine with the Catholics. There was no animosity. It's just when armies came and were going to take the city back. That the Muslims all said, we're not going to give it to you. There was nothing there. It was just rubble. But there were just nomads there. But because they were coming in with an army, it aggravated a lot of things. But they were going to force, Barry, they were going to force the Eastern Orthodox Church back under Rome. That was the First Crusade. Peter Lombard, he was a scholastic author of the four books on the Sentences, the standard theological text for the next 200 years. It influenced Calvin's Institutes. 1140, Peter Waldo. Where's Waldo? Well, he's in Lyons, France. I wonder where that Waldo name came from, but it might be that guy. He's the founder of an old Protestant church, 300 years before Luther. The Waldensian church still exists in some parts of the world today, but it's merged with the Methodists and the Presbyterians.
Sorry, what's the fill in there for?
Waldensian. W-A-L-D-E-R? Oh, sorry, D-E-N, my eyes. Walden. S-I-A-N. Sorry, S-I-A-N. Waldensian. 1147, 1148, the Second Crusade. Bernard of Clairvaux was the chief motivator of this crusade, but somehow his reputation survives it. It was a disastrous failure. The failure was blamed by the Westerners on the lack of commitment of the Eastern Church, and the wedge is driven deeper. We'll talk about those maybe once we get through. 1174, Peter Waldo is converted. Two of Waldo's followers, called Waldensians at that time, are laughed out of the Third Lateran Council after being tricked into saying that Mary was the mother of Christ. They didn't know what they were agreeing, that they were agreeing with Nestorius. The Waldensians are declared heretical, 1184. 1187, after the First Crusade, they retake Jerusalem. So you have now the Third Crusade. Here's an ineffective attempt to recover Jerusalem. The Fourth Crusade in 1200. The Crusaders finish this crusade by looting Constantinople on their way to Jerusalem, the seat of the Eastern Orthodox Church. So much for the lofty ideals of the First Crusade. They had promised that they were only trying to bring the Eastern Orthodox Church back under Rome. But they just went over there and they just stole everything. This gets absolutely a nightmare. Pope Innocent III proclaims a crusade, a papal inquisition, now against the Waldensians. Everything became a crusade. It became popular just to crusade against. 1212, one of the most unknown crusades is called the Children's Crusade. It is almost non-existent in most history books written by the Catholics. The Children's Crusade, the children felt they could take the Holy Land, supernaturally. That wasn't a lot of children, it was just a priest just rallied some children, and they believed that they could take the Holy Land supernaturally because they were pure in heart. Most of them were drowned, murdered, and sold into slavery on the way down. 1219, the Fifth Crusade, the Crusaders temporarily held Damietta in Egypt. Francis of Assisi went with the Crusaders, but where they stopped, Francis kept going. He went unarmed into the presence of the Sultan and preached to him. That's why St. Francis of Assisi is so revered. What are his writings? He's got, I forget something's popular by him. There's lots of popular writings by him. He actually was a man of great faith. He had I don't believe he ever had any salvation experience at all. But he really was pretty convinced that he was just living without an arm. He didn't carry a sword or anything like that. 1224, 1225, a guy named Thomas Aquinas. If you want to know where the Catholic Church's teachings were solidified, it was by him. He's a chief teacher of the Catholic Church, author of the Summa Contra Gentiles. Thomas Aquinas. He wrote an apologetic handbook for Dominican missionaries to Jews, Muslims, and heretics in Spain, and a second book called Summa Theological, The Sum of Theology, a theological textbook that supplanted Lombard's Sentences, the chief theological work of the Middle Ages. 1229, you have the Sixth Crusade. A guy named Frederick II temporarily gained Jerusalem by making a treaty with the Sultan. And then you have the Seventh Crusade in 1248. Let me just run down. I want to get to the Crusades as fast as I can. Pope Innocent III, he's the summit of papal power. The high water mark of papal power came during the reign of Pope Innocent III. He was the most powerful of all popes, claiming to be the Vicar of Christ. V-I-C-A-R.
What does that mean, Vicar of Christ?
Vicar is vicarious or in the place of.
So, in the churches in England, he's the village vicar.
I know, isn't that wicked?
What does that mean?
A representative. He means a representative of Christ. Okay. It's been watered down where they don't really think.
They are.
Now, yeah. I mean, a Christian, when we speak in the place of Christ. We're speaking what he would say if he were here. But they took their very presence as if I'm Christ for all practical purposes. Okay? They twisted the meaning. Well, I'm in the presence, I'm in place of Christ, and I have the power of Christ, and I can forgive or I can withhold forgiveness. That's how they saw themselves.
Or is it where Christ was?
It should be, but it's not. So they were known as the Vicar of Christ, the Vicar of God, and supreme sovereign over the church and the world, is your fill-in. You ever see SecureCorp? What is its symbol? It's got two keys. You ever notice those two keys? All right, those things look whatever. All right, and then you got another key going over the other side. Now, that's a papal symbol. What is that papal symbol of?
The keys of death and hell.
No, not the keys of death and hell.
The keys to
the spiritual realm and to everything physical. They have the authority. Those are the keys of this world. They have the key to your salvation, and they have the key to your safety in this life. And that's what the Pope... And you'll always see a Pope hat right there in the middle of it. You know? It's a papal symbol for SecureCorp, always. Look at that. It's just their symbol.
They don't have that.
Hmm?
They don't have that hat in their symbol, do they?
I'm sorry, you're probably right. They have this symbol, but the Pope has that. It's the completed symbol. That's his insignia. You're exactly right.
And the Trinity Fountain or something, and the Neptune rising out of the water thing. All these...
Oh, they do have all of the Greek and the Roman... Yep. In his address, he stated, "The successor of St. Peter stands midway between God and man, below God, above man. Judge of all, judged of none." In it later, he wrote, To the Pope has been committed not only the whole church, but the whole world with the right of finally dispensing the imperial and all other crowns. He also further stated, "All things on earth and in heaven are subject to the Vicar of Christ." You know, every dictator, every tyrant, every emperor believed the same thing. When Nebuchadnezzar came along, he says, "I'm the Lord over all lords. I'm the King of all kings." They all get this big head that I'm just there's nobody going to judge me. Well, now a religious man, a pope, is saying it. Innocent III ended the wars with Germany and brought the Church of Rome into supreme control of all the European states. He chose Otto as Emperor of Brunswick, saying, "He wears the crown by the grace of God and the apostolic see, the apostolic prophet." He defied two powerful kings. He refused to allow King Philip Augustus of France to divorce his wife, although he would allow others to divorce, putting him under an interdict, or an ecclesiastical penalty. He closed all the churches in France, banning masses and extreme unction for the dying out of payment or punishment. The result in panic and uproar of the people forced Philip to obey the Pope. In similar fashion, he forced King John of England to concede in a dispute over the appointment of the Archbishop of Canterbury. Oh, his works include, he ordered the Fourth and the Fifth Crusades against Islam. He decreed the doctrine of transubstantiation. He confirmed the doctrine of auricular confession. He declared by practice the doctrine of papal infallibility. He declared that the successor of Peter would never in any way depart from the faith. That was the beginning of believing that the Pope could never err. He condemned the Magna Carta, the Great Charter. This was the first English Bill of Rights set forth by the English barons in 1215. He says, that's obnoxious, that's ungodly to have people have individual rights. He forbade the reading of the Bible in the vernacular, or if you just want to write, in local languages. And he instituted an inquisition. He instituted an inquisition. When Hitler decided to exterminate the Jews, all he was doing was carrying out the Pope's wishes. It was a common thing in Europe, come from Catholics, where you exterminate what you think are your enemies. And so Pope Innocent ordered the extermination of all heretics. Anybody that didn't agree with the Catholic Church was to be exterminated. What do we do with heretics? Admonish them. And after the second admonition, leave them alone.
Wipe the dust off your feet.
Yeah, go on. But the Pope turned around and said, burn their cities. Throw their babies into the rivers. Bury them up to their chins in an ant pile. He did that throughout Europe. he was responsible for the horrific massacre of the Albigenses. Innocent III is usually regarded as the greatest of all popes, I should put it in quotes, in autocratic power, but this was only made possible because of the previous Pope Hildebrand giving him that power. Pope Boniface VIII, now comes the seeds of papal decline. A total of 16 popes followed Innocent III over a period of 78 years. It was marked by a struggle between papacy in King Frederick II of Germany, and then by a decline of German influences and the rise of Norman or French influence. So the French start to rise. Pope Innocent IV, he issued a papal bull permitting heretics to be tortured, their property to be confiscated for the church, and their names and the names of the accusers to be suppressed. So you could be accused and never face your accuser. You know, the laws that we have today are so good. And they come out of the Dark Ages. So, if somebody wanted to ruin you, Lisa, and if you were in Catholic Europe, all you needed was one person to go to an authority and say, let me think of something.
She's a witch, you lizard.
Oh, yeah. Well, I wanted to make sure it was not true. But anyway, she is a witch. Okay. I know it's not true. I was trying to be funny.
Right, just
you better be right. Anyway, she's a witch. In modern courts, except in the case of rape, they've made that exception. In modern courts, you have to face your accuser. If I make an accusation against Lisa that she's a witch, you must bring the accuser and the accused, and you have the right to face your accuser. And that was non-existent. They suppressed the information so you don't have to reveal your source. Hello, Mr. Hassan. And you can just present the accusation. You see, the foundation of what we take for granted in our legal system came out of great trial and said, if somebody's going to accuse Pastor Craig, you must have witnesses and they must be willing to come forth. If the people do not want to come forth, then it cannot go into court. Does that make sense? And boy, we need to protect that. And it is biblical that you must have two or three witnesses who are willing to come forth or just shut it down. Pilate wasn't going to listen to everybody's accusations against Jesus, he wanted to see witnesses. And when they didn't have, he said, I've examined him, and I find in him no fault at all. Even though there are lots of people accusing him, he said, there's no evidence. And he says, what are you doing here bothering me? You have no evidence. Go away from me. And they kept pushing. This is fundamental. If you want to know where our loss came from, it came first from the Bible through the furnace. It was forged in the furnace of such abuse by both secular powers and then later by religious powers. Pope Boniface VIII, this arrogant pope, led him in conflict with a number of European rulers, particularly King Philip IV, the Fair. And when Philip began to tax the clergy, oh man, boy, I wish that day wasn't here. They tax me, man. I wish I didn't have to get taxed, but they do. When Philip began to tax the clergy, Boniface threatened excommunication. Philip then refused to allow any church money to leave France. And in 1301, he arrested the Pope's ambassador on a charge of treason. That was unbelievable. Boniface then published his famous bull, Unam, U-N-A-M, Sanctum. Which claimed absolute papal supremacy over every ruler and territory. Philip countered by gaining the backing of the French Assembly, and in 1303 had the Pope kidnapped and thrown into prison. Hallelujah. I like this guy. Philip's my guy. Boniface died in humility, and the power of the papacy was actually broken. Oh, let's do the Crusades, because I wanted to get at least to here, and we'll be okay. Good. Stay with me. We'll be a little late today, but we'll be all right. During the period of absolute papal power, a number of crusades were instigated by the popes, the legates, and the Dominican monks. The crusades against Islamic domination of the Holy Land. These crusades were armed pilgrimages. What you do is you get a lot of very dedicated people who wanna go worship God, and you say, here, let's go kill some heretics on your way to worship God. 1 John says, as we talked about just in the last hour, if you say you walk in light, yet you hate your brother. Now, not that hating the unsaved is your brother, but if you walk in hate, I mean, what a stupid thing, and yet in your walk with God. Every Muslim believes that to worship God, the greatest way to worship God is to go into jihad. If I kill a Christian on my way to Mecca, man, I'm really doing good, amen? So, they're armed pilgrimages to the Holy Land under the banner of the cross. That's what they were calling them. The idea of a crusade was apparently suggested by a guy named Peter the Hermit. He said it to Pope Urban II, crusades were whipped up by the popes and the monks who promised special indulgences, forgiveness, for those who died in battle, sometimes even promising absolute salvation. The aim of these crusades was the conquest of Palestine and the defeat of Islam. There were seven major crusades mounted, all financed by severe taxation imposed by the popes. Aren't you glad the church can't tax you? Aren't you glad? Now they used to. You used to. And if you were in Germany, everybody's taxed to pay for the church.
Even now.
Even now. You have to declare what is your religious affiliation. And your taxes are collected to pay for that. If you're Lutheran, that's how the Lutherans make the money. You don't tithe. You don't give at the church. You just walk in and walk out because your tax money goes. Ireland's still the same. Ireland has several hundred, if not thousands, I don't know how many, but several hundred outstanding abuse claims still before the Murphy Tribunal finished, never resolved, counting in the tens, if not hundreds of millions of euros in damages that will never be paid because Taoiseach Albert Reynolds put a cap. And he said the church can only be taxed, liable for, I think, a total of, I forget how many. It was an unbelievably, infinitesimally small number, 60 million euros. And at that point, there was 2,000 or 3,000 people, there's 300 still left, and it's in the order of hundreds of millions of euros outstanding. The point is, government's still covering for the church still living off of the protection of the government. Let's go on. First Crusade, Proclaimed in 1095 AD by Pope Urban II of the Council of Clermont, it consisted of an undisciplined army of 30,000 men led by Peter the Hermit. After many bloody battles beginning... I mean, they make a great movie. I mean, this guy who's dressed in brown sackcloth and he's just got a stick in his arm. I mean, I don't think he carried a sword. And he walked... He led that battle straight beginning at Belgrade. Jerusalem was captured from the Selkut Turks in 1095. Very few crusaders survived the ordeal. The Second Crusade in 1147, for 2 years, the fall of Odessa to the Turks once again threatened Jerusalem, and a Second Crusade was instigated through the fiery eloquence of the Cistercian monk Bernard of Clairvaux. The expedition was a disastrous failure, accomplishing nothing except the postponement of the fall of Jerusalem. There was a film called The Kingdom of Heaven or something, is that right? Was that about one of the Crusades?
Yeah.
All right. Yeah. I always wanted to watch it just for that basis to see if they had anything good to show.
It was on like Network 2 from last week.
Oh, really?
It's really rubbish.
Was it rubbish?
It's so, like, I don't know, just cheesy.
All right, okay, I don't want to watch it now, all right?
All right. Cheesy good.
Cheesy good. Like pizza.
The only thing about those movies is historical, but it's the stuff that they were, and you know, see all the horses and the arrows. And
oh, you get
a picture of what
agreed.
It would look like.
Yeah. Again, Second Crusade failure. Third Crusade, 1192, very rapidly these Crusades would rally people and then send them down to Jerusalem. Jerusalem fell to Saladin in 1187. The Third Crusade involved the English under King Richard I. He's a good king. He's one of the most carnal, unsaved men you'd ever meet, but he was a good man. I mean, this guy, he had these words. He says, come on, men, he who goes first goes cleanest. I don't know if you understand that statement, but he said, you know, that sword's going to be used on more people, so might as well get it done first, get killed first, because the sword's cleanest. Anyway, he had a good attitude. It's called Richard Lionheart. He wasn't afraid of anybody, even the popes, but he along with the French, under King Philip II, and the Germans, King Frederick I, Barbarossa, Redbeard, this crusade was a failure, marked by accidental drowning of Frederick, constant feuding between Richard and Philip, and the murder of 2,700 Muslim POWs by King Richard, a move which only served to further brutalize hostilities between the Christians and the Muslims. When I say he's a good king, I mean he wasn't good, but he was a man's man. You read about some of the things he said and how he rallied the troops. If you ever saw a movie called King Henry V, that I liked. That was one of those movies where it actually showed the ability of one man to rally 30,000 men to fight a battle that was unwinnable. And that just impresses me. Fourth Crusade. This crusade never made it to the Holy Land and degenerated into an attack upon Constantinople, resulting in its capture and plunder. Thus was ushered in a period of Latin rule over the Greek city lasting until 1261 for about another 60 years. The Children's Crusade is an aversion. It's a mess of events with similar themes. A boy began preaching in either France or Germany, claiming that he had been visited by Jesus and told to lead the next crusade. Through a series of supposed portents and miracles, he gained a considerable following, including possibly as many as 20,000 children. He led his followers southwards towards the Mediterranean Sea, where it is said he believed that the sea would part when he arrived, so that he and his followers could march to Jerusalem, but it did not happen. Two merchants gave passage on seven boats to as many of the children as would fit. The children were taken either to Tunisia and sold into slavery or died in a shipwreck. In some accounts, they never reached the sea before dying or giving up from starvation, exhaustion. So the guys that put them on the boats actually sent them down to slavery. Here are 20,000 children that their parents said, bye-bye, honey, go get Jerusalem back. I mean, this is the mentality, 20,000 children. And they were all, none of them came home. Fifth Crusade. Pope Innocent III died before seeing this crusade begin. It was not until 12 years later that King Henry II embarked on an expedition which concluded in a diplomatic peace with the Saracens. The Sixth Crusade, this was led by Louis IX of France, but it ended with his capture, obliging the payment of a large ransom. Seventh Crusade, Louis IX, most of his army was destroyed at Tunis by pestilence. And this is the last, in 1291, the last Crusader stronghold in the Holy Land, Acre, fell. Almost 200 years of mostly futile effort, the novelty and fervor of being a soldier of the cross had waned. The Crusades were often marked by savage butchery and encompassed severe persecutions against Jews who were regarded by Catholics as the killers of Christ. They often failed because of jealousy between kings, military leaders, knights, and soldiers. How many of you remember Robin Hood? It was said at the time of the Crusades, wasn't it? Oh, they always portray it in a nice thing. The old films about Robin Hood were very honoring of the king. King John. Or Prince John, sorry, and King Richard. Which Richard? Richard Lionheart here. Okay.
Prince John, he was a bad guy?
No, Prince John was his brother. And he was a bad guy. They always portray him as bad, I understand. My point is, it was like the Crusades were so good and it was so honorable in the movies. The Crusades failed in three respects. You better remember this for the final. Number one, the Holy Land was not won. That's a failure.
Is that W-O-N or O-N-E?
W-O-N. Secondly, Islam was not defeated. And three, the great schism in the church was not healed. S-C-H-I-S-M was not healed. Nevertheless, the Crusades did bring some positive results. Number one, Europe was kept free from Islam, at least most of Europe. The world was opened up. Men's horizons were enlarged, and this helped pave the way for the Renaissance. Renaissance, as some people pronounce it, R-E-N-A. R-E-N-A-I-S-S. A-N-C-E. Renaissance. What does Renaissance mean, Dan? Well, you're halfway there, but...
Rebirth.
It is a rebirth. It's like it's almost new, but it's a rebirth. It's Renaissance, French. And then Reformation. So it paved the way for the Renaissance and the Reformation. Up until that time in the Dark Ages, where was everybody? Stuck in their village, stuck under the darkness of the Dark Ages. Nobody was allowed to question anything. Nobody learned anything for nearly 1,000 years. Now as they spread out and they started to go to war, people started seeing the bigger world. They started learning. They started finding out that the big world out there had a lot to offer, had a lot to learn about. The Crusades against the heretics. The influence of the Cathari or Albigenses in the south of France became so great that Pope Innocent III moved against them. In 1209, a crusade led by Arnold, the abbot of Citeaux, and Simon de Montfort, the earl of Leicester, was mounted against these Bible believers and noted for its inhumane cruelty. Hundreds of thousands of men, women, and children were mercilessly butchered, mutilated, cut down, burnt, and starved to death. Over 250,000 are known to have been slaughtered. In 1210 and 1211 AD's armies were mustered or organized. Only because of the intervention of the sympathetic court Raymond of Toulouse were these people spared total annihilation. Nevertheless, the churches of Languedoc were seriously affected by these brutalities, and the comparatively few survivors found refuge in the mountains and valleys of the Pyrenees, in Piedmont, and the Rhine. The Lateran Council of the Fourth, I forget what N stands for, in the north, charged the Catholic bishops with the task of ferreting out and punishing all heretics. In 1229, the Council of Toulouse further organized Inquisition, and in 1232, the work was turned over to the Dominicans, nice peaceful group, who were directly answerable to the Pope. Thus arose the Inquisition, which exercises power with somewhat varying rules in different countries, but one of the most terrible engines of intolerance and tyranny which human ingenuity has ever devised. What you're seeing in America and the world right now is the beginning of a new Inquisition. What do I mean by that? All right, you have a few terrorists.
You have a few terrorists affect the World Trade Center, all right? They attack America, so to speak. That results the next stage in what we call the wars against Iraq and Afghanistan. Neither one of them succeeded, yes or no? They didn't succeed. So the next stage after that is you turn on your own people. When your war doesn't work, you've got this mentality of fight, and you turn it against internal terrorism. Now, America and Europe is monitoring and analyzing every move in the name of national security. I am totally against it. So you've moved from a few terrorists now to where all over Europe and all over America, you're no longer free. And it is wrong. And yet they say, well, we have to have national security. We have to do this. We have to have, in America, it's called the Patriot Act. It's the most unpatriot thing ever done. But they have to monitor. They have to watch everybody because they're not allowed to watch only a few. They have to keep it all even keel. They have to keep it so there's nobody able to say, I'm Muslim, so you're targeting me. I don't know if I'm making any sense. My point is this. When the Crusades failed, they turned inward and they attacked terrorists, heretics, among themselves. Do you see what I'm saying? Okay? And that's what happens in a home and a family. When a battle outside cannot be won, debt, loss of job, friends abandoning you, health problems, and you can't fix it, the next logical stage that the devil moves you to is all of a sudden you will attack your wife. You'll attack your kids. You'll attack your parents. And you attack within. That is the next logical course. So the devil will move you from a simple problem through to where you're all of a sudden, it's a big problem, you're trying to fix it, and it won't fix. This is the psychological path, a demonic path that leads you to where all of a sudden a church can self-destruct simply because we had a few problems we couldn't deal with. And so ultimately we just turn to hatred of one another. This is the process that everybody goes through. This is where Ireland is right now. After, in the next 4 years, I'm predicting, not prophesying, I am predicting that when Ireland does not get out of this debt, Ireland will not only lose all sovereignty, but Ireland will, unless there's a revival, and I pray for that, Ireland will turn against itself. And everybody, no, Ireland will cease to be Irish. Where they have time for one another, where they have any grace or kindness to one another, because it'll get so tired of carrying this load that we will see each other as the blame. Do you understand what I'm saying? This is what was going on coming out of the Crusades, now into what was now known as the Inquisition. So the Inquisition was an attitude that says, we can't fix the problems out there, so let's fix the problems in here. And they start to go against anything and everything that was not lining up perfectly with the Catholic Church. Yes, sir?
So the possibility is the Irish government looks on the people as the problem.
Right now, the government... Yeah, yes.
Looking at that...
That's right. Right now, the government is accepting kind of the blame. But after a while, the government's going to say, you're not paying enough taxes. I don't know what they're going to do, but they will make... Everybody will blame one another. And it will just, it is a dangerous time that we're living in. What's it going to be over the next 5 years? I don't know. But people, knowing human cycles, governments will become what we call totalitarian. They will have an iron grip because the people will riot. This country, which as placid as it is going to join the Greeks. In 4 or 5 years, it's going to be too big of a burden. Yes. I don't know if Jesus actually identifies the pattern, if I can see the pattern of what Jesus said there, but it just shows that things don't get better and better. Things go through cycles, and they actually end up worse and worse. Yeah. The next state after anarchy, this is what where you try to quell anarchy, and the next state after that is revolution. And that's the Antichrist. We are so close to the coming of the Antichrist to bring peace on earth. All right, we're going to stop there.
We have to stop there for the year, for the semester. For your final, okay, you're going back into Smyrna. Do I have a previous? We've done, this is Thyatira. I don't have my lesson on Smyrna. Let me see if I can find it. Huh?
Last time,
did we end with Smyrna, or is it Pergamos? Sorry.
Pergamos is the first one I have here.
Yeah, we started with Pergamos.
Okay.
Okay. When you went through Pergamos, let's see, we dealt with a lot of junk. And I do call it junk. I want you to remember the series here of seven churches. We have seven churches running throughout church history. The first church, we call it the Ephesians. I call it the Ephesian church age, right? All right. The next church age, the next church period after that, after Ephesus, was Smyrna. After Smyrna comes Pergamos. After Pergamos comes Thyatira. After Thyatira comes
Sardis,
thank you. I think you're right. After Sardis comes 6 is Philadelphia. And after Philadelphia, the last one is Laodicea. All right. Each one has a time frame. The Ephesian church age runs from 33 A.D. up until, what did I say? I want to say it ran till 250-ish. Let me make sure of my date. You're going to want to know these just... Where did we have it defined? All right, 100 A.D. Sorry, I'm right. 300 to 100. Actually, going back to your... It's page 15 in your notes from the first semester. 100 to 300. 300 to 500, 500 to 1200, is that right? 500 to 1500, 1500 to, did I say 17? Yep, 15 to 1700, 1700 to 1900, and 1900 to the present is the Laodicean age. What do I mean by that? All right, this is, if you were to, I need some other colors. Stay with me, and we'll summarize this as fast as we can. So, in church history, I would say in the Ephesian church, you've got a good basis for what Christianity is. The only thing that they struggle with and they start to fail on is what? Not doctrine. Their first love. So, from here, they start to mess up. Okay, Smyrna deals with a lot of persecution. Pergamos. And Thyatira, by the time you get to Thyatira and Sardis, this is how church history goes, okay? Doctrine suffers. Walk with God. Walk with others, especially Christians. Everything just collapses. It is a church state. A church-controlled state, controlled country, all the way down Philadelphia, which we'll have to get to next semester. Philadelphia picks up, and all of a sudden, there is a skyrocket. It restores back. And that's only during this period of time that we, after the Reformation hits, and things start going back to the Bible, do things get back upright. And in just 200 years, we are repeating the same cycle again. Okay? That's human nature. You need to know these dates, the names of the churches in order. You need to know the general decline. And we've been going through, I mean, we're here in Thyatira. We're seeing crusades. We're seeing the fights between popes and kings. That should not be happening with Christianity. Christ said, if my kingdom were of this world, We would fight, and we will not fight. And yet no pope ever lived by those words. Going through, and starting with Pergamos, you want to look at people, a very important person, Constantine, Jerome, Pelagius, what was his problem, and his heresy, Patrick. What is an Arian? Barry, what do Arians teach?
Jesus wasn't God, he just thought he was going to be.
Good. He was not God. Let's see, you need to be able to explain the Latin Vulgate. Why was it written? Major, you need to be able to list major heresies in Catholicism. You need to be able to list who was the first official pope. Who was the first official pope?
Leo
the First. About when? I don't remember either. I don't remember. It was, was it 340? Are you right, Barry? I will. Okay. Barry, Leo the First is 440 to 461. What'd you say?
Around breakfast time.
Around breakfast time, yes. You need to know who the Donatists were. And whether you, don't worry about some of these, I don't know, the Nestorian, the Eutychian, you don't have to worry about them, but I will ask you completing some of their heresies and their doctrines. And I sometimes I may ask you, is there a refutation? What is a verse that actually refutes their concept?
Nestorian, is it?
Like the Nestorians, the Eutychians, the...
So we do have to study them.
No, just review them, but you don't actually have to be intense. I just love scaring you. You want to get you want to get a date? A lot of the dates, I really don't want you to, I want you to get sort of an idea, but, who knows who the first head of the Holy Roman Empire, what was his name? The first king of the Charlemagne. Charles the Great, that's what it means.
Was that the guy that got dug up and went on trial or something? Or did he dig someone up and charge of heresy? Who was that pope? I thought that was Charlemagne.
No, Charlemagne wasn't a pope. He was the king of Germany, king of what was known as now the Holy Roman Empire.
Was that a pope that dug up the other guy?
There was another pope who dug up, they did it several times, but they especially dug up a guy named John Wycliffe. After he died, they found his bones, dug him up, burned them, and then crushed them, and then threw him into the river. Really hurt him. So,
do they think that that would stop him from being resurrected?
It mainly, I'm not sure what they thought. It mainly was as a show to the next generation not to mess with the Catholic Church. It was always to scare others from following. And yet they call them Lombards, and yet the Lombards continued to preach and they grew.
In Belfast, there's a street called Lombard Street.
Amen. Ah, listen. When was the last time? Now all the streets have names like, they have no meaning. I mean, Rose Street, but it's named, you know, instead of named after somebody or after something, right? In America, they're renaming all the Washington Avenues. You ever notice? I don't know, you know anything about that. But every town had a Washington Avenue, a Lincoln Avenue, Jefferson Street. They're all being renamed. You know, Rose, Brown Street. Huh? Elm Street, I guess. I don't know, but they're getting rid of history in what we came from. It's weird. Yeah, all those don't exist in Ireland either anymore. I'm sure they got rid of those too. But all right. do I care? Give me the name of the God that Muhammad promoted. What does the name Islam mean? What does it mean? Submission.
By any means?
Unfortunately. Describe transubstantiation. And then when we just deal with who was Peter Waldo and what were his followers known as?
Did they start the Walmart? No.
How many
people Waldens in the Sword Church?
I don't know. Did we have Waldensians? Are you sure? Is that what they called themselves?
Yep.
That is cool.
Americans.
Did they? Well, they'd be very close to us. They'd be Protestant. Baptistic. Yeah, they are Protestants. Yeah, but they... Waldo didn't. Who was the reforming pope?
Did you ask how many of the crusades were there? Is that what
I will ask you how many crusades. There are literally seven by number... But there are, you better remember, there are eight, including the Children's Crusade. The Children's Crusade was not an official crusade, even though 20,000 died. So there are eight, remember that. List me why the crusades failed. I already gave you those three. And when the crusades failed, what was the next thing that the church turned to? What was it called? The Inquisition. Okay. Take a break.